This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Elections this past Sunday were held in 28 nations across Europe for the EU Parliament. The results give us a fascinating look at the thinking among European voters and could have some interesting implications going forward. We're going to have a conversation with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this. We'll also talk to our Jerusalem Bureau reporter Brent Noctegal about renewed fighting in Syria. After 8 years of war there, the government is trying to regain control of one of the last pockets of resistance. And this battle has some interesting prophetic ramifications. Also, this coming week will mark 30 years since the Tiananmen Square massacre in China. If you're old enough, you surely remember the footage that made its way to our television screens here in the West. I was in high school at the time and remember those images. China is unapologetic for its murderous authoritarianism 30 years ago. In fact, under Xi Jinping, it's becoming even more authoritarian. We'll hear a report about this from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. At the end of the show, I have a last word about spine. Why you need to have a strong one, both physically and metaphorically, and how to strengthen yours. We'll begin, though, with European elections. To talk about this, we have via Skype from Edstone, England, Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So if you would first give an overview about European Parliament, what is this body? How does it work with all these disparate parties from 28 countries, what their job is, and so on?
Sure. So the EU is this big conglomerate of 28 different nations, and they know that it doesn't look good to not have a parliament or to not have some democratic body. So the European Parliament is their kind of token attempt to look a bit like a democracy. Hmm. So they have all of these MEPs that get voted in from across the country or from across the continent. They have pretty much no power. They can't initiate legislation. They can't repeal legislation. All they can do is, in some circumstances, veto legislation and appointments. So it's their fig leaf of democracy. And across Europe, because Europe doesn't have, you know, it's not one kind of community where you have the same political party in all of these different countries. Instead, you vote for your local political party that you are used to, and then they form alliances with political parties that think in similar ways at a European level. So, for example, there's the European People's Party in the European Parliament, and that's kind of one of the main center-right bodies. And so within that European People's Party, you have people like Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party, and then all of these other different center-right groups from other different countries.
Okay, so these parliamentary elections actually got quite a substantial turnout, or at least it was the best that it's been in some years after some decline. I suppose you have a lot of Europeans who recognize that this isn't necessarily the most powerful body and don't feel particularly motivated to turn out to vote for it. But it does seem like Europeans had something to say this time. And we've been following the trend in Europe for quite some time, the decline of the political establishment, the collapse of the status quo politically, and the rise in more extreme political parties. And that pretty much seems like what played out in these elections. Give us the overview of what you saw.
Yeah, so you had this two related trends where people voted either for the Greens and environmentalist parties or these more extreme left-wing parties. You had this so-called green wave across Europe. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you had people voting for the more fringe right-wing parties or far-right parties. And in a lot of countries, you had them doing well. So much so that one of the big outcomes of this vote is you know, forever, since its existence, the European Parliament has always been dominated by the main center-right and the main center-left party. The two of them just about always get together in coalition. And then they have a majority, and then they just dominate everything. They take up all of the main posts, or almost all of them. They dominate the business, etc. For the first time, they lost that majority now. They only have 43% of the seats. So you're seeing this shift away from the mainstream party to the fringe parties, and you're seeing that play out in so many different European countries that it's having an effect at the European level, where even the European just kind of aggregate is the center is losing in parliament there.
So the loss of the center in favor of the far right and the far left. Could you just talk a little bit about each of those two trends? Why the far right is gaining more popularity, and what do you make of the rise in the left as well?
Well, I think it's people just don't like the mainstream. I mean, if you look at what's happened in Britain, you have parties that the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, between the two of them, have governed the UK for the best part of a century. And in this election, the Conservative Party got 9% and the Labour Party got 14%. You know, these two parties that dominate British politics couldn't even get a quarter of the vote.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of trend you're playing out. Now, the people that are abandoning those parties don't necessarily know where to go. I think they know what they don't like. And maybe they do, depending on their proclivities, you know, whether they lean left or they lean right, they're going to the more extreme. But it's basically, we don't like the middle. We don't like the way we've been governed typically for the last few decades. We want something different. And I think what's interesting is in Britain, there's a very clear cause for that: Brexit.
Yeah.
This results for Britain weren't surprising. Everyone was expecting that. For Europe, there's not a simple one-word cause, but you've got the same kind of crisis as you have been caused by Brexit. Now, those causes are things like the migration crisis, the euro crisis. It comes from these different causes, but still, you've got a similar kind of crisis going on in Europe where people are abandoning those mainstream parties.
The exodus away from the establishment in Britain was so great that we had a party that didn't exist 2 months ago as the biggest winner within Britain, the Brexit Party. Any other standout results across Europe that you saw?
Yeah, so in France, you had the what used to be the National Front. I always forget its new name. Our National Rally, the far right or far left party led by Marine Le Pen. And she won. They beat French President Emmanuel Macron. They did well last European elections as well. But still, you know, they kind of tried to turn this whole referendum, and Macron did too, into a referendum on Emmanuel Macron's premiership. And Macron lost. He lost barely, but he lost. And so that's a big victory for the fringe and a big defeat for the mainstream. You remember Macron, he was, you know, he has kind of put himself forward as the figurehead for mainstream Europe. The one that's going to kind of lead to the revival of this more center-left type Europe that's he's put himself up as an opposition to all of these upstart parties, and he lost in his own country. Mm-hmm. Then you had Italy again. You've got these upstart parties make up the government of Italy, so it's not like there's a major surprise here. But you had the League winning 34% of the vote. That's massive for them. That's significantly bigger than they had even in the election result that set them up as part of this governing coalition. So they're just going from strength to strength. Their coalition partner, the Five Star Movement, again, a fringe party, a party set up by a comedian not all that long ago. They'll probably be a little disappointed with 17%, but the fact that they can get 17% and be disappointed by it, you know, shows how far they've overturned Italian politics. And meanwhile, again, the traditional party, kind of Forza Italy, the traditional center-right party that would rule Italy, all the way down to 9%. So dramatic example of that same trend. Then Germany is probably one of the most important to watch. And again, this was a continuation of exactly the same trend that we've been watching in Germany. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote about this this trend away from the mainstream in Germany in the January Trumpet print edition. And we saw that even more. You know, both the center-right and the center-left party in Germany received their worst election results ever in the European Parliament. Mm. The Social Democrats even came in third place, so behind the Green Party. Meanwhile, in some parts of Eastern Germany, you had the Alternative for Deutschland. You know, this far-right and sometimes almost neo-Nazi party was the most popular. You know, they came first in some states. Now, their overall showing was relatively low, 11%. They didn't do well in the West, but they did spectacularly well in the East. They have some pockets of support that are just really strong there. And so because Germany's coalition is a coalition between the center-right and center-left, and they both got a drubbing, there's a lot of people now saying, well, you know, this puts this coalition in danger. Spiegel used exactly those words, in danger. And they wrote, the instability can lead to a breakup at any time. The Council on Foreign Relations talked about the center-left party, the SPD. Well, that panic is spreading among the SPD membership. So we can keep an eye on the German coalition after this result. They had an emergency meeting yesterday, but big signs of the same kind of uncertainty and unrest within Germany as well.
And you would expect that that would put even more pressure on Angela Merkel to exit the stage sooner than later. She's already, we know she's on her way out at some point, but she's going to stick around for a little while longer. But let's turn our attention to Austria, not necessarily directly related to European parliamentary elections, but quite a shocking result there, development there.
Yes. Just going back to your point on Merkel very quickly, though, she's coming under pressure, but not just – she's not the only one coming under pressure. The person that she wants to succeed her is coming under pressure to resign as well. So you're seeing the potential for Merkel going and a new successor to Merkel. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with her and also the main leader of the center-left party. So – strong appetite for new leadership and a lot of dissatisfaction with, you know, not just the people that are in charge right now, but also the people that are lined up to come behind them.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yes, going to Austria with Sebastian Kurz, you've had this Ibiza-gate, I think is the the term that they've had for it. This big scandal going back a week or two in Italy, where the Freedom Party of Austria, this far right group that's in coalition with the government, they were caught being corrupt, basically offering to give lucrative government contracts to someone who they believed was some kind of dodgy Russian businessman, businesswoman, in exchange for party donations. You know, donate for our party and we'll give you these lucrative government contracts. Now, that ended up in Sebastian Kurz firing them from the government, ending his coalition agreement with them, calling for fresh elections. But to the center-left there, the SPO in Austria, that wasn't enough. Now he no longer had majority in the parliament, and the Freedom Party were mad with him for throwing them under the bus like that. A lot of his enemies kind of all got together, got a majority in parliament, and passed a motion of censure, or put forward a motion of censure against his government, passed a motion of no confidence in Sebastian Kurz, making him the first chancellor in history to be pushed out of office with a vote of no confidence. Now, I don't know, to me, it seems like they're just being a bit too clever by half. You've got they had the opportunity to stick the knife in and they took it, but the elections were already scheduled. You know, he was there as a caretaker prime minister.
Yep.
He did very well in the European elections on Sunday, despite, you know, so voters weren't punishing him for the sins of his coalition partner, even if the opposition politicians were. So, you know, as far as I know, it looks like he's still going to be leading his party in the elections that are probably going to be in September. A date hasn't been formally set yet. So he could well be back. But I think it's just interesting to see this descent of politics now into, it's similar to the United States, you know, where it's beyond just the normal back and forwards of elections. But some of these tools that are meant to be there for extraordinary situations are now being grasped for by political opponents as just a tool in the fight. You know, in the way that the Democrats will talk about trying to impeach President Trump, it's something that's meant to be there for emergencies, but they're trying to look for any way to use it. And you see something similar then with Austria with this motion of censure, motion of no confidence. And it shows kind of a political fight now reaching a new level of animosity where people are prepared to go beyond the bounds that would normally be set in politics. And that's, you know, that's dangerous. That's when you start to get into where people are willing to harm the government or go against, undermine democracy if they're going to any lengths, if it means undermining their opponent.
We've been just viewing all of these developments politically within Europe through the lens of biblical prophecy. Obviously, we're looking for a strong leader to emerge in Germany, but we're also looking for a collection of strong leaders across Europe that are a certain kind of leader. And it seems like Gerald Fleury has definitely been drawing attention to Sebastian Kurz as being one who is cast in that mold, having a certain connections to the Catholic Church, certain political bent and connection with his people, certain popularity and very smooth operator, and just certain elements of his leadership that very much seem to fit that mold. The fact that he's experienced this, it seems like the way that this has unfolded, it could actually boost his popularity in the long run. You do wonder if the voters watching this happening and seeing this play out the way that you're describing, that politics are descending into these kind of personal battles, if they would not punish those people and empower Kurz all the more when those elections come around. Does it seem that way to you?
It does seem possible, and it seems even that, you know, there's reason to expect that based on the European elections. I mean, some of the countries we haven't talked about where the parties in power did well are Hungary and Poland, who have kind of, we've drawn attention before, these almost strongman type leadership that does mesh quite well with the way Kurz does things, especially in Poland. There's people saying, well, actually, it was the Catholic Church that really helped the government get an election result that was a lot better than a lot of people were expecting them to receive. So, you know, based on what we've seen in Eastern, and both of those leaders have been under similar kind of attacks, especially Viktor Orban in Hungary. You know, they've kind of tried to, mainstream European leaders have thrown the kitchen sink at him, and he comes back with his party with 53%, the only political party to win a majority of their country seats apart from the Labour Party in Malta. So you've seen that happen to those countries. I think we could see that. Well, we could well see that in Austria. Or I think the other potential is that, you know, the left go beyond constitutional norms to go after Sebastian Kurz. Does he respond by doing the same thing? Or maybe he'll in kind reach beyond democratic norms. And that's what the Bible talks about happening for the strong man that we're watching for to come to power. You know, the book of Daniel talks about this strong man coming to power within Germany, and that's the main place we're watching. Though, as you said, you know, it talks about these other kings that would serve under him in Europe. And Daniel specifically talks about him coming to power through flatteries. And you start to look into what those words mean. And it's basically, again, outside the democratic norms, not through the typical process. The Bible has a lot of very important prophecies about this coming strongman coming in Europe. And so when you see democracy start to break down, when you see all of these mainstream democratic parties losing votes, when you see people just kind of saying, well, we want anything different, something different, we don't know what, we want something different to what we have now, we'll look for the far right, the far left, we'll look anywhere. The ground is ripe for that kind of leader to come to the fore. And that's exactly what Mr. Fleury wrote about in his January Trumpet print article.
Yeah, the title of that article, Germany, a New King is Imminent. We appreciate that, Richard. We've been talking to Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about European Parliament elections this past Sunday. He wrote about this in his Trumpet brief yesterday. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A new wave of violence is sweeping through Syria as the government of Bashar al-Assad tries to capture an area in the north of the country from anti-government forces. This is creating another wave of refugees from Syria. To talk about the implications of this development, we have via Skype from Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So if you could just start by describing what's happening here.
Yeah, this offensive has begun. Well, it's been going on for about a week now, and it's in Idlib province. This is a province that borders Turkey, close to the coast, but not touching the coast of the Mediterranean. And it's really the last holdout or place where you have Syrian rebels. The Syrian civil war has gone on for nine years, or almost 9 years now. And as the government of Bashar al-Assad has gained power, they have left a way of retreat, in a way, for the rebels to, as they take over more territory, a place for them to go. And that is Idlib province. It currently has 3.5 million people residing there. About 1.5 million of those are internally displaced Syrians. So this province had about 2 million before the civil war started. Now it's got 3.5 because you've got everywhere from people have retreated there. And the type of people that have retreated there are all sorts. They are what we would call definitely terrorists, offshoots of Al-Qaeda that have been fighting against the Syrian regime. But also you have there all the Syrian dissidents, journalists, vocal supporters, just regular people that hated the Syrian regime and wanted a change of government. They had to escape the Syrian regime also, so they've gone there as well. And so you've got these 3.5 million people that are basically stuck there. And if people might remember Idlib province from late last year, I think it was September, October last year, when it looked like the Syrian regime and the Russians were going to go in strong and finally wipe out the 50,000 remaining fighters in Idlib province. And President Donald Trump came on and said, Russia and Syria, you better not do it. Hold off, because it's going to cause a mass migration of refugees trying to spill over into Turkey and then up into Europe. There's going to be bloodshed. How about we figure out something to stop this from happening? And so Turkey was involved in negotiations. Turkey's obviously there as well with some of their forces. They are basically providing safe haven for the time being for some of these jihadis, as well as they've got their own interests. But basically back then, this offensive was stopped, and which is kind of like Russia's way of working, as we've noted for so long. They push, they gobble up territory, they wait, but now they're going for it. And so already we've had 250 people that have been killed. You've had the same old tactics by Assad, barrel bombs, 18 hospitals attacked, 300,000 people already leaving their homes from this province, trying to go elsewhere, but really with nowhere to go. And so this looks like a humanitarian disaster.
This is a huge surge of people already, 300,000 people.
Right. And it's only the beginning. I mean, if this goes, I mean, Assad, of course, wants to get rid of this problem. This is kind of the last area that he can't control or doesn't control, that's close to the important territories in the west of the nation. The north and the east, he doesn't care about as much. That's where the Kurds are. He'll let them have their piece of land because they're not a great threat to him. But these Syrian rebels still are. Again, with 50,000 fighters there, a lot of them are willing to fight to the death. And so right now, 200,000, 300,000 people have been sent packing. This could get a whole lot worse if this offensive goes to the extreme.
It says a lot about just how much Assad's position has been strengthened. The fact that, well, you know, first of all, it's been years that we've been saying this guy is probably about ready to be ousted. What do you make of the fact that here we are, just if it was 6 months ago, 8 months ago, that both Assad and Russia backed down when Donald Trump said, hold off for the time being, and now they're saying, okay, we've waited long enough?
Yeah, I think it obviously speaks to his solidified position inside the nation. And I think the United States had a chance back in 2013, probably early on in the Civil War, and underneath President Obama to knock it on the head, to go in strong, and to really force regime change there. That wasn't done because of the nuclear deal and all these other things. And then we had President Trump when he came into power, and he had a show of force regards to Syria, with chemical weapons being used by the Bashar al-Assad against his people. And you had those Tomahawk cruise missiles fired from the Mediterranean against the air base that was used. And so you had this moment of time where the Syrian regime and the Russians were wondering what's going to happen. But again, nothing substantial has happened with the United States and Syria. He said, Mr. Trump, that he wants to draw down his forces there. And so they are going to try and push as far as they can. Now, I don't think I think this is something that Russia and the Syrian regime, yes, they want to get rid of the terrorists there as they see them, and some of them definitely are, but they also do want to put pressure on Turkey, on put pressure on Europe as well. This could be a future bargaining chip for them. Europe, obviously, at this point, with its extremely fractured nature, with nationalist governments coming into power, as we just saw in the European elections over the last day or so, they do not want more refugees coming into Europe. And so there might be something more going on here. I don't think we're going to have a full-on run of a million people into Europe. There's probably going to be some bargaining that's worked out with Russia, Syria and the Europeans to maybe set up some type of safe zones. This is something that they've said that they wanted to do. Let's create a safe zone for people that aren't terrorists in northern Syria. The Syrian regime has said we'll accept that. The Turks have said good. Turkey's built up a fence of 500 kilometers in the past couple of years along this border to prevent refugees from coming across. So they don't want this to happen either. And so it might be that under the previous agreements, there were European forces that were to come in and manage these safe zones. And so that might be something that we see coming on. Maybe the Europeans will be enticed to act to prevent a humanitarian disaster and a wave of refugees if they'll put their own forces to guarantee some protection from these civilians.
Well, it certainly will be interesting to see Europe's response to what's happening here. And of course, just prophetically speaking, we've drawn attention to the prophecies of Syria and Europe actually aligning with one another at some point. And you look at a mess like this, it's difficult to see exactly how this is going to play out, obviously, but it is something that we're watching for. Let's talk about Iran. The implications for Iran in what's happening here. Their position in Syria continues to be diminished. Talk about that.
Yeah, even with this offensive, you don't really have the Iranians being mentioned at all. There might be some Hezbollah fighters that are participating in it, but Iran is definitely not calling the shots here in Syria right now. It's Russia that holds the power. And what we've seen over the past probably week and a half is numerous articles come out that talk about Iran's diminished role in Syria because of a number of factors, one of those being the financial sanctions that America is putting on the Iranian regime. I think we talked a little bit about this on Friday's program and how if Iran wants to strengthen its hold over Syria, it's got to fund proxies. It's got to fund the IRGC, its Quds force there. It's also got to fund other proxies to work inside Syria to ensure that its interests are upheld. And right now, what we've seen is the inability of the Iranian regime to fund those. There was just a report that came out from the Wall Street Journal today that said that all of the previous buyers of Iranian oil have stopped buying, including China. This is big because we thought that China would not accept those U.S. sanctions. But the Wall Street Journal, talking to Iranians that are meant to be selling this oil, said that they can't get any Chinese government officials or smaller Chinese companies to buy up Iranian oil. They've put oil on tankers and the tankers are out at sea, but the Chinese aren't buying it. And so you've got this. Like, again, hydrocarbons, I think they form about 70% of the Iranian export economy. And so if they're not being sold to anybody, then Iran is going to face some severe economic crisis. And one of the things that they will have to preserve is the Iranian regime and its hold over its people. And so pulling back from Syria could be one of those positions.
That's very interesting what you said about China actually abiding by these sanctions and other buyers of Iranian oil, considering and as you've made this point before, the fact that Iran's presence in Syria is so contingent on its being able to maintain itself economically because of those oil exports. The fact that the United States sanctions against Iranian oil are actually loosening Iran's grip on Syria, that would be one of the knock-on effects from American sanctions is quite interesting.
Yeah, it is, definitely. And it does speak to the resurgence of American power in the Middle East. They might not be there bombing people, but sometimes you just have to cut off the financial lifelines, and you will see the Iranian regime weaken. It won't weaken to the point of regime change, I don't think, unless there is some type of physical action. But as Bible prophecy does indicate, they are going to lose certain of a certain hold on Syria that they have right now. And this, the lack of finances is certainly going to lead to that. The other factor that's very important here is that when Iran invited Russia in to help them stabilize the Assad regime, Iran basically thought that the Russians would be there, they'll bring down their airplanes, help us out, we will secure the Iranian, so we'll secure the Syrian regime. And then the Russians thought that the Iranians would leave. Iran doesn't normally do this, where they have a proxy force in the country and stay there. They normally have proxy forces that are Iraqis or proxy forces that are Lebanese. And so, of course, they're going to stay there. But in Syria, they don't have that hold. And so Russia probably thought, as had been the calculus of Iran, that they would leave when the Syrian regime was preserved in Russia and would have their people there and it'd all be good. But because the Iranians have stayed there and tried to use it as a forward operating base against Israel, then the Russian gains have been jeopardized, because the Russians intend to build up the Syrian regime with its own contractors, get all those lucrative business ventures going forward. It doesn't want to compete with Iran on the ground there. And so you've got a couple of these things all coming together at the same time. You have a lack of finances, which means Iran hasn't got the money to stay in Syria. You also have the Russians putting pressure on the Iranians, actually fighting in some instances against the Iranians, putting pressure on the Assad regime to break off the relationship with the Iranians. That's being reported commonly in the Iranian media, that the Syrians and the Russians are doing business deals behind the Iranian back. And then you also have Israel that decides that it's not going to stand down. Iran might use it as a forward operating base, fire missiles like they did back in May 2018 against Israel, and Israel mobilized its air force in a way we haven't seen since 1973 to knock out half of Iranian's infrastructure in Syria. And so since that time, Iran hasn't done much against Israel because it's not in a position of strength. And so at some point, the Iranian regime has to make a decision. Is it time to pull back and preserve our gains elsewhere in the Middle East?
Everything that we're talking about, I think if you've been following the trumpet for some years, you're seeing these patterns, and you're seeing these things pointing toward these prophecies that we've been talking about time and time again. For someone who's uninitiated, Brent, where would you send them to catch them up to speed?
I would read an article that I wrote late last year. It's entitled "The Imminent Iran-Syria Divorce." It goes through our 20-year forecast for Syria and talking about how it's going to fall out of the Iranian sway, Iranian hold, based on prophecies found in Psalm 83 and Daniel 11. It's very clear that Iran, while it is going to still maintain its power in Iraq, in Iran, and elsewhere in the Middle East, Syria is one of those battlegrounds that it's going to lose, and it's going to lose eventually to a European force. While the Europeans aren't that clearly involved yet, stage one of that prophecy being fulfilled would be for the Iranians to exit, and prophecy is aligning for that to take place.
And given what's happening there, it would not be surprising to see Europe take a more aggressive posture in trying to stem the flow of immigrants. So we could definitely see some movement on that front as well very soon. Thank you very much for that, Brent. We've been talking to trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the latest developments in Syria and the government's offensive there in the north. He's working on an article about this for thetrumpet.com on the subject. You can watch for that on the front page. In the meantime, read that article, "The Imminent Iran-Syria Divorce." We'll put a link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thanks, Brent.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
China is about to pass a grim milestone in its authoritarian history. And the fact is, as the nation grows more powerful internationally, it's becoming even more authoritarian as well, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
on the streets leading down to the main road to Tiananmen Square. Furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots. Heading down the road was a hazardous business, but hundreds of people cheered as buses were set alight and army trucks caught fire too.
June 4th, 1989, is a date written in history with blood. It was on this day that the Chinese Communist Party shocked the world by massacring thousands of China's own people. And now, as we approach the 30-year anniversary of this shameful massacre, its reverberations are still being felt in China and around the world. 13 years before the Tiananmen Square massacre, China's longtime leader, Chairman Mao Zedong, had died. Mao's Cultural Revolution had kept China mired in darkness, poverty, and rank corruption for decades. But shortly after his death, Deng Xiaoping launched wide-ranging programs to reform the Chinese economy. In the late 70s, Deng began moving some economic sectors away from the collectivist communist model and towards privatization. And he opened the Chinese economy up to the world. The result of these reforms was stunning. Throughout the 1980s, China saw astounding economic growth. Millions of Chinese began to be lifted from poverty. Books, both Chinese and Western, that had been banned under Mao, began to be circulated and taught. Many Chinese people gained some exposure to Western ideas and standards of living. And many felt that China needed more reforms and deeper, more meaningful change. University students took the lead in calling not just for greater economic reform, but also for political reform. The students believed communism had been proven to be a failure, and that the Chinese Communist Party should stop governing China so dictatorially. The students believed the people of China should have a say in how their lives were run. The students believed that the people should have individual rights, democracy, and freedom. In the early spring of 1989, a politician who had encouraged democratic reforms died. On the day of his funeral, tens of thousands of Chinese university students gathered in the ancient Tiananmen Square in Beijing. They used this funeral as a chance to rally together in their calls for reforms and freedom. And over the next several weeks, the students and other individuals seeking reforms continued to assemble in the square. At first, the government only issued stern warnings to the mounting crowds. But the demonstrations soon began to spread to other Chinese cities, including Shanghai, Nanjing, Chengdu, and about 400 other cities. More and more people were joining in the protests because they believed life for them and their children could be better than it was. They knew the Chinese Communist Party that controlled the country was corrupt and self-serving. These people wanted opportunity and a chance to live stable lives without having the government grow wealthy off of their backs. The protests were infused with genuine hope that China could become a democracy and a land of opportunity and prosperity. A few of the Chinese Communist Party leaders thought the government should negotiate with the protesters and make some real changes for China. But the hardliners in the government, including Chinese Premier Li Ping, were terrified of where it might lead if the government started to give in. They feared that their power could come to an abrupt end, and they feared that they could personally suffer violence if a full-fledged revolution were to take root. So the government decided to forcibly suppress the protests. Around the middle of May, martial law was declared in Beijing. The government stationed troops from the People's Liberation Army around the city. But the troops couldn't reach Tiananmen Square because the protesters were flooding the streets and blocking their approach. For several days, the tensions rose, and finally, on the evening of June 3rd, tanks and soldiers were given new orders. Advance to Tiananmen Square despite anyone who may be in your path. Throughout the night of June 3rd and 4th, the People's Liberation Army shot their way toward the square. They mowed down any who stood up to them, and they took the square.
After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd is still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government." A huge volley of shots just as I left the front line caused panic. The young man in front of me fell dead. I fell over him. Two others were killed yards away. Two more people lay wounded on the ground near me.
By June 5th, the military had secured total control of Tiananmen Square and all of Beijing. And the Chinese Communist Party immediately went into damage control mode. They downplayed the number of those who had protested, they downplayed the role that the army had had to play, and they said that the death toll was minimal, just a couple of hundred civilians. But a British diplomatic cable was declassified in December of 2017, and this cable had been written on June 5th, 1989, by Sir Alan Donald. At that time, Sir Alan was Britain's ambassador to China, and he wrote this just about 24 hours after the carnage, providing eyewitness testimony of just how savage and heavy-handed the massacre was. Sir Alan explains that a few waves of soldiers were sent into the square unarmed, initially just to break up groups of demonstrators. And then came a military company called the 27th Army of Shaanxi Province. And Sir Alan wrote, quote, "Students understood they were given 1 hour to leave the square, but after 5 minutes, armored personnel carriers attacked. The 27th Army's armored personnel carriers opened fire on the crowd before running over them. Armored personnel carriers ran over troops and civilians at 40 miles per hour. Students linked arms but were mown down. Armored personnel carriers then ran over the bodies time and time again, and the remains were collected by bulldozer." End quote. Sir Alan also gives horrific details about wounded female students who pleaded for their lives but were bayoneted to death. He wrote about a young mother who was shot as she tried to go and help her wounded 3-year-old daughter. The final sentence of Sir Alan's report says, quote, "Minimum estimate of civilian dead, 10,000. End quote. So 10,000 is his estimate, and this is also in line with the estimates from U.S. intelligence. I visited Tiananmen Square in the summer of 2017, and with children playing in the sun and thousands of people posing for photos and sipping iced tea and lemonade, it was hard to envision the kind of savagery that had taken place there. And that's just how the Chinese Communist Party today wants it. They've tried to erase this massacre and the pro-democracy protests that led up to it from history. A few Chinese people, however, refuse to forget. They sometimes use a code date, May 35th, to talk to each other about what happened on June 4th. By using this code, they were originally able to have discussions without being flagged by China's army of internet censors. Now, even May 35th is scrubbed from all online discourse within the Great Firewall of China. If anyone brings the Tiananmen Square massacre up in public, they can be punished and even incarcerated for it. This history from 30 years ago this week remains painfully relevant for China and the world now. Many China analysts say the Tiananmen Square massacre divided modern China's history into two phases, before Tiananmen and after. Before it, the people had a reasonable amount of trust in the Chinese Communist Party. They never thought those tanks would open fire on men, women, and children. After it, the Chinese people are afraid to test the government's determination to control the country at all costs. And this is especially alarming when we consider just how powerful China's current leader, Xi Jinping, has become. In early 2012, Xi was basically unknown in Chinese politics, but he assumed the office of General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party in November of that year, and in the time since, he has adopted a strongman approach to government that is eerily reminiscent of that of Mao Zedong. He's rewritten the rules to erase all term limits, and this means that he'll be free to rule China for as long as he lives. So as we approach the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, we should be sobered to remember that the same Communist Party who authored that savagery is still in power. They're still rewriting history to help them keep a tighter and tighter grip on their power. They have 1 million Chinese citizens in concentration camps right now to unlearn religious ideas that might threaten the party. The Communist Party is still armed to the hilt, and they're looking to expand their power far beyond China's borders, and they are led by an authoritarian with remarkable determination, and might. The trumpet watches Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party's tightening grip on power because Bible prophecy reveals that as U.S. influence in global affairs declines, two main power blocks will emerge in its place. One will be a European entity operating in the tradition of the Holy Roman Empire, and the other will be an Asian bloc that the Bible calls the Kings of the East. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has pointed to passages in Ezekiel 38 to explain that this Asian bloc will be headed by Russia, with China in a secondary leadership position. The Bible makes clear in such chapters as Jeremiah 50 and 51, Daniel 11 and 12, Revelation 16, and Matthew 24, that a clash between this European power and this Asian power, led by Russia and China, will contribute to the most violent conflict in human history. It'll be far more violent than what the Chinese who longed for democracy suffered 30 years ago in Tiananmen Square. The fact that Xi and the Chinese Communist Party are more powerful and more determined to use their power than ever is deeply significant. When we understand these scriptures, we see that it's vital for us to watch the Chinese Communist Party's military and its foreign policy, because it indicates how the Chinese president could fall in line with his fellow strongman in Russia, and it also gives us an indication of just how near this future clash between the Europeans and the Asians is. This points to a dark and chaotic time in the near term, but the Bible shows that the time of darkness and chaos will be closely followed by the brightest imaginable future. Mr. Fleury writes about this future in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, saying, quote, "This immense war between European and Asian forces will end in the return of Jesus Christ. The conclusion of that battle will mark the beginning of a peaceful and prosperous new age for the entire earth."
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. That is really fascinating history. I appreciate you putting all of that together. And I, you know, the numbers from that report that came out in or that was released in 2017, I had never heard that. That is absolutely shocking to hear of just how many people were killed in that incident. Looking at the current regime, you know, you were even mentioning just how, say, the control over the internet, some of the control of information within that country shows just how authoritarian the reign of Xi Jinping is. Looking back at that history, what evidence do you see that say that they would be willing to take similar like military measures or a harder line, say along the lines of what they did 30 years ago?
That's a great question, and I would say the low-hanging fruit, the easiest way to answer that, the most obvious area is in Xinjiang, which is the northwestern part of China, and it's populated mostly by Uyghur Muslims. And lately, the Chinese Communist Party has begun to feel deeply threatened by this Muslim minority population in Xinjiang, and so they've constructed a whole array of, they call them re-education facilities, but really that's kind of a euphemism for concentration camps, where these people are sent to unlearn their ideas. They're taught to hang pictures of Xi Jinping or Mao Zedong in their houses and their places of worship in place of whatever, you know, relics they traditionally would have there. But there have been just numerous deaths, and it's incredibly heavy-handed. It doesn't get that much attention in the Western presses, but it's a shocking crackdown on something that the Communist Party feels threatens them. And I think that indicates just how dangerous this party is and how well-equipped to, you know, use its power it is.
So would you see the pro-democracy wave that was happening in the lead up to Tiananmen Square as the high water mark of that that development within the country. It's the way that you were talking about it. Really, since then, it seems like the Chinese have kind of backed away from trying to make those types of moves.
From what I can tell, that would have been the high water mark, not necessarily because there's less of a desire for a democracy among the Chinese people, but just because they now understand how utterly determined the Chinese Communist Party is to, you know, stamp out any kind of efforts toward reform. And so I think the people now, what you see is just a recognition that they have to keep their heads down, fall in line, be good citizens, work hard, and let the Communist Party continue to increase its power, you know, from their work. It's in many ways, it's kind of a slave economy. But I don't know what it would take for another uprising like that to happen, just because there is respect and fear among the populace, and they just probably wouldn't want to risk it a second time, seeing how it went that first time. But I would encourage anyone who wants to know more about China's role in Bible prophecy and how we can kind of get a glimpse into what's ahead from looking at this dark, dark history. I would encourage them to read Mr. Gerald Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, which really goes into depth with the Bible prophecies on this topic. And I've also got an article in the works that hopefully will be published on thetrumpet.com soon.
All right. Well, thank you, Jeremiah. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about China on the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Thanks so much for your time.
Great to be with you.
It's time for today's last word.
If you had no spine, your body would be like a bowl of Jell-O without the bowl. It'd be like a skyscraper after demolition. You know, when they blow it up and it falls directly onto itself in a heap of rubble. Your spine is the anchor for everything in your body. Your head is perched on it. Your rib cage hinges on it. Your muscles are attached to it like lines to the mast of a ship. A strong backbone enables you to stand upright, to remain balanced, to move with confidence. It has 24 individual ring-shaped bones called vertebrae, which serve as a protective case for your spinal cord. That's the main highway for information from the brain to every other part of the body. If you cut that cord, you'd go numb and lose muscle control. Just about every animal has a backbone. Lions, bears, fish, birds, snakes, even insects have one, though theirs is often on the outside of their little bodies. But what's the best an animal can manage to be without having a spine? A jellyfish, a squid, or a worm. If you look up spine in the dictionary, the first definition will be something like the vertebral column, backbone. Everybody has one of those. But around the fourth definition, you'll probably find a quality which constitutes strength, resolution, stamina. Though it's just as important, this type of spine isn't nearly so common. And it was this latter meaning that Elbert Hubbard intended when he wrote, "It is not book learning that young men need, nor instruction about this and that, but a stiffening of the vertebrae which will cause them to be loyal to a trust, to act promptly, concentrate their energies." Loyalty, prompt action, concentration, energy. Those things come with having a strong metaphorical spine. Having a spine means working hard in school or on the job, even when you feel like ducking away. It means doing what needs to be done. It means following through with what you say you'll do and fulfilling your responsibilities. It means earning a reputation for being Mr. or Mrs. Dependable. Having a spine means not going squishy or limp under pressure. It means keeping anchored, standing up tall for what you know is right. As it says in Exodus 23 and verse 2, "You shall not follow a multitude to do evil." Having a spine means sometimes not being afraid of confrontation. It means not being a coward. Deuteronomy 31 verse 6 says, "Be strong and of a good courage. Fear not, nor be afraid of them. For the Eternal your God, he it is that goes with you. He will not fail you nor forsake you." Having a spine means speaking the truth and saying what needs to be said, even when it could have frightening consequences. Having a spine can mean knowing when to admit you're wrong, putting the truth above your own pride. It means being upright, honest, loyal to God, loyal to family and friends. Often it means putting others' needs above your own. When you hear someone called a spineless worm, usually that means he put himself first, even to another's hurt. Having a spine means being tough. You're not a squid. Your body was made to be used, running and dancing, swimming, chopping, lifting. You can take it. Too much TV, too much video games, and you actually start looking like a jellyfish. Having a spine will hold your life together, just like it holds your body together. It'll preserve your relationships and ensure success on your job. The English Standard Version of Proverbs 10:9 says, "He that walks uprightly walks surely, but he that perverts his ways shall be known," or "he who makes his ways crooked will be found out." Walk uprightly. An individual with a strong physical and moral spine, the blessings are immeasurable. Now, granted, it's not easy. It takes effort to develop and strengthen real backbone. It doesn't come naturally. You may have been born with 24 fully functional vertebrae in your body and still be a mental or emotional quadriplegic. When we talk about spine, we're really talking about developing the most important thing possible in your life, the thing that will enable you to die happy: character. So how do you strengthen your backbone? First, you learn the right way to live. Just keep that up your whole life long. Study the right way to live. Know that way. And next, buckle down and do what you know you should, no matter how hard it is. And then when you fail, that's the most important time to show some spine. Get back up and try harder. And most importantly, look to God to supply you the strength you need. He promises in Isaiah 41, "Fear you not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yea, I will help you. Yea, I will uphold you with the right hand of my righteousness." That's where the character you need ultimately comes from. But God will only give it to you as he sees you going after it. Is your backbone weak? You have everything to gain from a stiffening of the vertebrae, developing some spine. Stand up to the challenge. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to Josh Sloan and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe: "Talent is nurtured in solitude. Character is formed in the stormy billows of the world." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.